the number one thing that I have personally felt or found is drives adoption and success is, do you cost time or do you save time?
Welcome to the Better Care Podcast, where we tell the stories of clinicians, healthcare leaders, and innovators who are improving the way clinicians work and deliver care. On today's episode, Evidence Care's co-founder and chief medical officer, Dr. Brian Fengler, interviews Dr. John Hamler, senior fellow of innovation at OSF Healthcare. This interview was recorded in front of a live audience at an Evidence Care employee event, so you will hear some questions from the audience at the end. Dr. Hamler shares engaging stories from his journey as a physician and coder and how he used those skills and experiences to overcome and accelerate technology adoption at top healthcare organizations. He also provides feedback on how healthcare organizations and providers can learn and grow from the tsunami of AI that first and foremost benefits the patient. Anyone who has struggled to implement new technology in a hospital or health system will gain a lot of useful info from Dr. Hamler. Enjoy this episode.
Well, with me today, I have Dr. John Hamler. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is a special Better Care podcast because we have it here live as part of Evidence Care Palooza. We do this twice a year, and this week our theme is game shows. So I'm going to be your game show host today.
Yeah. Excellent.
So John is a physician. He attended medical school at the University of Chicago.
University of Illinois at Chicago.
Sorry.
But we're good. One of those institutions may or may not be happy if we
Yeah. Completed his residency in emergency medicine at Georgetown, which is part of MedStar Health, which the team is very familiar with. Interestingly, while at MedStar, he was involved in the development of an EHR called the Zixi. That then got acquired by Microsoft. So John spent part of his career as the chief deployment architect for Microsoft's Health Solutions Group. For 2 years was the CMIO at M-Modal, which we have many connections with in the group. 6 years as VP of Digital Innovation at Baxter Healthcare. And then most recently, you've been the Senior Fellow for Innovation, which is that even a job?
It was after we made it up.
Okay. At OSF Healthcare, which is a 15-hospital system with a headquarters in Peoria, Illinois. So, John, to start off with, and this might be good just to get off the table to begin with, on a daily basis, do you consider yourself a physician or a coder?
Wow, is that an awesome question and a tough one. You know, we were just talking about that out there. Well, first of all, let me just say, in case I say anything off that I wish I hadn't said, everything that I'm going to say, let's just assume it's me and not necessarily representative of my employer. Okay, but now let's go. So I spend much more of my time doing coding stuff, but all my coding stuff is virtually always in healthcare and therefore always informed by my physician background. And, you know, when the time came that I had retired from clinical practice, but I had to, you know, recertify for emergency medicine, it was a lot of work to restudy, especially because I wasn't practicing actively anymore. And I had to decide if it was worth it. And at the end of the day, I decided it was just too much work and too much a core of who I feel I am, regardless of whether I still practice or not. And so in my heart of hearts, I still consider myself a physician as much as I consider myself a coder, because at the end of the day, those two things are virtually always coming together.
Yeah. Another one to get us going here. What makes emergency physicians the best innovators in healthcare?
I think we see so much innovation coming out of folks who've been involved in emergency medicine for a whole bunch of reasons. And I thought about this for kind of a long time. First of all, I think when patients come into us, unlike many other healthcare situations, it's an urgency or an emergency in most cases. And we don't have a relationship with those patients. In fact, you could say that virtually always we have no relationship with those patients. And so that means we're virtually always starting from scratch. And we have this We have no control over how many people come in. We have literally no control over anything. We're so super reactionary. And so for us, that creates a whole set of challenges. How do you manage the volume? How do you manage the acuity? How do you manage the breadth of anything in the world could come in? And because we have so many challenges, that just creates a melting pot of opportunity where A, we now have need. So, and need is kind of the mother of innovation at the end of the day, right? There's a need, you fill it with innovation. And the second piece is the people who sign up to do a job like that are going to be the kind of people, I think, who may be a little bit more than usual likely to come up with those kinds of innovative solutions. So that's what I think. And we'll see if I'm right someday. Maybe someone will study it.
I think I always thought people who go into emergency medicine are multidisciplinary problem solvers.
Yeah.
And that's what makes them go into emergency medicine. And
exactly. They deal with a lot of problems and they want to deal with a lot of problems. And that's a recipe for wanting to do innovation.
Yeah. Let's go back a little bit to the development of Azixi. You and I talked a little bit about this yesterday. When MedStar started developing that, you guys were already using, some form of electronic system, but decided to develop Azixi. What were you guys looking to develop? And you talked a little bit yesterday, how did you guys have success, which was a very interesting the way you mentioned that you guys kind of rolled it out that you think led to the physicians actually wanting to use it.
I got to watch at the beginning of the development of Azixi. These were some of my best friends that were developing it, but I was at Northwestern while they were at MedStar, but we were in close contact because we were working on a whole bunch of things and we were really, really, really good friends. And so I got some of that development. I got to watch as a first row audience member as opposed to participating and then later actively participating in it. So my buddies, Dr. Craig Fiat and Dr. Mark Smith and Fidrik Iskandar, who had really the original developers, they came to an emergency department that was really, really struggling in terms of patient satisfaction, volumes, just all the issues that a struggling emergency department might have. And they recognized that a key to succeeding here would be information technology that was not available at the time. Mm-hmm. And they had been thinking for years about what information technology, when they were at GW, which was, we had a kind of a dual emergency medicine residency with GW and Georgetown. When they came from GW to take over the MedStar emergency department, they saw IT and innovation in information technology and informatics as the key to success for their department. In addition, of course, to the people, the process, and then the third wing, the technology. So they built what became Azixi, and suddenly all the information that about every patient that was available in the hospital was now at the clinician's fingertips. And today, maybe this doesn't seem so radical, but you can only imagine in 1996 or seven, that wasn't anything like the case. Every lab test, going back for as far as we had data, every EKG, which used to live in a separate system, every X-ray, which used to be hard copy, every video angiogram, everything was suddenly there, every handwritten note they would scan in. So now the emergency department clinicians could provide much better care, obviously. Well, consultants would come down from the rest of the hospital. The nurses, they were resistant at first, some of the nurses, and they said, we don't need any more technology. It's just going to get in the way. So they said, okay, then only the doctors will use it. And then the flip side of that was, then some of the nurses got angry and said, wait, this can't be only for doctors. Nurses should get to use it. So it was, and then the rest of the hospital said, you can have that in the emergency department, but we don't want your technology bothering us up here. So he said, okay, this is only for emergency medicine. And they said, and your thing hasn't been adequately tested. So he said, fine, we're just beta testing it. So he put a sign up on, when I say we, I mean my colleagues, put a sign up on the computer that had Azixi on it, the first one, and it said, only for beta test emergency medicine. So everyone thought it was great. And the consultants would come down and they'd be wondering, wait, I need this information for my patients as well. So they would line up to the computer, lift up the don't use beta test sign, use it, and then put the sign back down and step aside for the next person to use it. And eventually we took the sign off, said, okay, we're not in beta test anymore. And we never pushed it to the other departments. The other departments said, the same ones that said, we don't want your technology by us. They were the ones that said, wait, this is really useful. We demand you give this to us. And so we never pushed the technology onto anybody. We had other folks decide it was useful and pull it to them.
So obviously, so Zixi got acquired by Microsoft, and not just in your time at Microsoft, but just knowing what you know about the industry and all the challenges, you know, we've had a lot of big companies with really unlimited resources try to get into healthcare. And obviously with Walmart, you know, with their recent issue, realizing that it's hard to get into healthcare. But with these software companies, from your experience, what have you seen as sort of some of the challenges that they face, or maybe some things that you would do differently now knowing what you know about how to get adoption, how to get utilization, how to get the best value from software and healthcare?
That is an interesting and difficult question. By the way, I'll say all those stories I just told were stories that happened before I got to a Zixi that I heard from my buds. And it was interesting then once I joined the team to, and then to get, when we got acquired by Microsoft, to get on the other side of the fence and have that experience through Emodal and through Baxter, and then to come back again on the flip side to the provider side again and be at OSF. And so it has been interesting to see the challenges that healthcare brings, and especially for incumbents who haven't been in the space. One of the big challenges that we face is that the buyer is very often, and the decision maker is very often, not the user of the technology. And so there's a disconnect in terms of, you can get people to buy it, but then how do you get them to adopt it? If they don't adopt it, then how do you get them to get the value out of the thing? And so there's a lot of challenges there. And a lot of those challenges, many of them relate to the economic drivers of why people acquire, you know, technology and software and services. And so very often you see that the thing the buyer wants to buy is something that will help keep them financially solvent, which is obviously important. And the thing that the user wants is something that will help make their life easier. And those two things are not always the same thing. But when they're not the same thing, then you have an issue where it's hard to get the return because you can't get the adoption. And so I think these are some of the challenges that we generally face. In terms of, very specifically, we also suffer from, very often in healthcare, there's low margins, there's constant pressure, economic pressure. And if you haven't dealt with that before, and if you haven't fully optimized things, then it's very difficult to come in and get it right off the bat. And so yeah. I think we've seen that over and over, is that as folks come in, they realize how hard healthcare really is, and you either learn or you struggle.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned to me yesterday a little bit about how one of the companies you were with sort of struggled with advancing things because you were so focused on making each customer happy. You were never able to really evolve the product and make it better as a whole.
That's the classic innovator's dilemma. You know, how do you service your current customers while also, you know, drive innovation forward for the future? The other thing that I think is, as I think about those sorts of experiences that I've had, or the ones that I've seen out in the marketplace, or that, you know, on both sides of the fence, there's really a big difference between doing everything that is asked of you and doing what is best for the customer. Sometimes that's not always the same thing, because the customer knows their goals, but they don't always know your product. And the newer your product is, the more innovative it is, the more different it is in terms of how it works and what it does and what it's trying to accomplish, the less likely it is that what the customer is doing today, that those things are going to perfectly fit with what your system does. You may be coming in with an innovation that attempts to that makes a return on the investment, that provides its benefit by doing something differently than what people normally do. They may buy into the end goal of what you're trying to accomplish, but if they're not bought into how you're going to get there, that's a recipe for disaster. And so that's where you have to be super duper careful about what customers you take on and how much you need to listen to your customer, but listening to your customer doesn't mean sometimes the best service you can do for your customer is helping them to understand how to best work with your product, even if it's not what they think is the way to best work with your product.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So you're at OSF now, doing a job that you made up the title for. So how does OSF thinking about innovation and digital health and, you know, what kinds of things are you guys working on?
We think of innovation in a number of different ways. We have both internal innovation and we have external innovation. So external innovation is where we partner with companies that that are doing innovative things and then bring them into the fold. We also have a ventures group that invests usually in things that, maybe always in things that have potential to be used at our institution. And then, of course, we do a lot of internal innovation. We have research and grants and things to do R&D and develop new capabilities internally. And some desire to, as we develop things internally, to even potentially commercialize them externally. Mm-hmm. And we look at innovation. I think we have three horizons. I don't run that particular part of it, but we call it, I think, horizon one, two, and three, which is really the time frame in which the innovation may occur. So the more incremental stuff, I would imagine, I think, is in horizon one. Then there's the midterm things that will take a little longer to develop. And then the most disruptive, risky items that are probably farther out, but if we don't get started now, they'll be never, are the horizon three items. And I tend to spend a lot of time in horizon three, but also a reasonable amount of time in horizon two and one as well.
Okay. A few people on our team know about it, but you okay talking about clonopin?
Sure.
Okay. You've spoken at several conferences about it. And, you know, I was very interested when I first saw what you were developing with clonopin or heard about it. Share with the team, what is clonopin and what is it that you're developing and why is it that you saw the need to develop it?
This is one of those stories that I'm sorry to say for all of you out in the audience goes all the way back to 1995 or something like that, or six. But way, way, way back in the day when the internet was a baby, we had a website, me and my buddies, the same ones who were at MedStar, Mark Smith and Craig Fiat and my friend Mike Gillum. We created a website, National Center for Emergency Medicine Informatics, and it was just a labor of love. It wasn't a business at all. We just did it because we thought it was fun and cool. And one day I had this idea. It hit me, oh my goodness, all these clinical scores and calculators and formulas and things, we could put them on the internet and then it would be accessible to anyone. And today you're laughing, probably thinking, well, of course you would do that. But at the time, I think it was pretty unique. I mean, it was hard to know. We didn't have great search engines at the time. So we made this thing called eTools, NCMI eTools, and we had something like 100 calculators and formulas and decision support things. And as we started building, Zixi and I got onto that group, we thought, well, wait a minute, we could just incorporate this right into our system and automatically calculate these scores. And one of the challenges that we had was, yes, we could, and we did do that. But it was still a place where if you wanted to go see it, you had to click on it. You had to go there. Well, you didn't know when you went there, were you going to see anything interesting or not? And at the end of the day, as soon as you hide something behind even one click,
it's gone.
It's gone. You know, the usage drops to a tiny, tiny fraction. And so we started thinking it would be great if we could ambiently just push this information. The problem was, is that the classic paradigm in healthcare for when you wanted to push something to somebody's eyeballs was to do an interruptive alert and, you know, pop up a thing that says warning, narcotics cause drowsiness. And then you had to click, okay, thank you. First of all, you're telling me something I already knew. Secondly, I was busy. That wasn't the most important thing I needed to see. So people started getting wary of the interruptive alerts because they were just causing a lot of dissatisfaction and false pauses, and people were ignoring them and just clicking them away, even when they turned out to be important. So they really limited the interruptive alerts in most of the best practices, were to say, just limit these to the things that are really, really the most important. So now we kind of had two paradigms. One was the interruptive push, which was a good way to make people pay attention, but you could only surface so many things there. And then you had the pull, which we didn't think was, in our experience, used as much as it could be. And so we had this idea that if we could ambiently push the information to clinicians' eyeballs in a non-interruptive fashion, and if we could use the full power of multimedia technology so that it wasn't just text, you know, you could just video or whatever, graphs, whatever you wanted to show, that maybe this would be another interesting way to surface decision support. And I looked around, thinking about this and talking about this, me and my colleagues for years, I didn't see anything that did exactly what I wanted to do and the way I wanted to do it. And so we got some grant funding and built it. And that was what Clinipain is. It's essentially, it's a bar that hogs up a small amount of, I say hogs up, but it takes up a tiny amount of space on the side of your screen, basically lives next to the electronic health record, communicates with the electronic health record back and forth so that it knows what patient you've selected in the electronic health record. Then it goes out and says, okay, well, here's some interesting decision support that you might find helpful. And it only shows information if it thinks that information is going to be useful. And if it doesn't find any information that it thinks it's going to be useful, it takes a smaller stance on the screen. And so we did a lot of work, and we actually had a second grant to try and design the user experience with user experience and human factors experts to try and design a user experience that the content was meaningful, that the behavior was meaningful, that we didn't take up too much space on the screen, but we took up the right amount of space. At the end of the day, it turned out to be, no surprise, a lot of work. And now we're in the process of kind of wrapping up what we need to do to actually implement it. And it all seems good in theory. Will it actually be good in practice?
Yeah.
I'll let you know when we deploy it.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to steal a quote. I hope I get it right. Conversation you and I had a few months ago, but you said something to the effect of, and this is in regards to AI and digital innovation and the way clinicians are thinking about it right now. And you said something on the lines of there's a tsunami coming that most clinicians are not ready for. You want to talk a little bit about that?
I don't think it's possible for anyone to be ready for the tsunami that's coming. And I think it will have an effect on everything. And healthcare will be one of those things. I'm going to also quote somebody. Bill Gates said something to the effect of, the world will change less than you expect in 2 years and more than you expect in 10 years. And I think that's the nature of technologies that have an exponential curve in terms of their development. We as humans tend to think of things in linear terms. And so, you know, you look at the plot of a curve and you think, you know, well, it looks kind of linear at first, right? No, this thing's only got 1% of the market. Oh, this thing's only got 2% of the market. Well, okay, that actually was a doubling. You know, the number is still small, but it did double. This thing's only got 4% of the market. You know, you wait a couple of years and you're like, oh my goodness, this thing's got 80% of the market. What happened? You know, and you look at the curve, it went like this. That's because we tend to think of, well, it went up by 1 or 2. So you think it's going to keep going up by 1 or 2, but actually it's going up by 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. And I think that's what we are currently seeing with generative AI and these large language models, is we're seeing that kind of exponential growth. And I think it has the potential to be very disruptive. That's a good thing and a little bit of a scary thing as well. It's a good thing because I think healthcare could use some disruption. I think many of us feel that we could do much better in quality. We'd like to see much better in quality. We'd like to see costs come way down. We'd like to see better experiences overall. If this is a path to get there, that will be great. And at the same time, will AI take over my job? You know, will AI be evil, as we've seen in some science fiction TV shows, or will it be beneficial? It's hard to really say where that's going to go. And so it's both scary and it's exciting at the same time. And it's really incumbent on us, I think, as that tsunami is coming in, to do all that we can to make sure that it does the best to service society and to service in healthcare the patients that we're committed to help.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of really cool things are, you know, you obviously get exposure to a lot of different things. What some cool things that you've seen? Don't have to mention companies, but that get you really excited and get you saying, that's really interesting.
I have this great set of jobs that I've had because I do get a lot of exposure to a lot of things. And it's interesting because as I get interested in one area, then I go deep in that area and I see all the interesting things that are happening there. And then I go in another area and I see all the interesting things that are happening there. Luckily, I have some friends that are always also passing me, you know, the latest and greatest that's happening in science and technology. And so I get a little bit of exposure to things where I'm not going deep as well. I think there's amazing opportunities and things that I see on the horizon in sensors, right? As much as I love AI, sometimes I feel like we're trying to squeeze blood out of a turnip or whatever is the right, thing, right? It's like, what we really need is just a better input. And then our models can be a whole lot better. You know, it's like trying to, I'm sorry to go medically geeky here, but you know, back in my day, the way you made a diagnosis of a heart attack was you had the patient's history and then you did an EKG. Then we got this blood test called a CKMB, but that wasn't actually as awesome as we wish it would be. And then came the troponin. Right? Suddenly there's this blood test and it's like the gold standard. Like at the end of the day, if that thing's positive, you probably had one. And if that thing's negative, you probably didn't have one. And okay, somebody's going to quibble with that and I'll go with them. But at the end of the day, the troponin was amazing, right? Now we have sensors that can detect what's happening in your body. We have, you know, point of care tests. We have those glucose things that continuously will measure your glucose. And I think we now have the ability to tell what's going on in the human body much better and much more continuously than we ever have. And I think that's going to be one transformative piece. That's going to feed into predictive models and make those predictive models just that much more powerful. And so I think there is a synergistic aspect to that. The other side of the fence is what's happening on the therapeutic side. So and of course, I can't leave off proteomics and RNAomics. In computer vision, there's just so much that's happening there that's super exciting. I loved now we've seen how AI has allowed us to have portable MRIs that use a fraction of the energy that they used before. So now technology that was costly and inaccessible to folks suddenly becomes accessible. And then the therapeutic side, because at the end of the day, what good is it to tell me that you've accurately diagnosed my disease, but you can't do anything about it? Like, I'm getting older. It's time to start getting some therapies that work, you know? And we're starting to see that as well. You know, the antibody-based drugs and CRISPR now that we, look what happened with the COVID vaccine. And we got a vaccine that, you know, helped us with a deadly worldwide pandemic, produced in record time, you know, using new technology. And we've seen now genetic therapies for incurable diseases starting to come to the fore. I just read an article. It wasn't the original article, so it's a lay article. I don't know if you saw it where, and I may get some of the details wrong, but there was a child with congenital deafness due to a genetic disorder. They injected CRISPR or something or other into the child's cochlea. The child can hear.
Wow.
We're seeing genetic treatments for coming on the forefront that may be there for sickle cell disease, maybe for juvenile diabetes. Anyway, I think it's an exciting time. And when I look at those things, I think, great, and go faster because I'm not getting any younger.
All right, I have just a few more questions and I want to open up to the group because I know we'll get some great questions from the audience. First one's a fun one. You come up with the idea for this amazing new app that you want to develop. It's going to take 100,000 lines of code. How much of those lines of code are you writing versus ChatGPT or some other assistive software?
You know, it's hard for me because this stuff's new and I am still a little bit old school. I'm embarrassed to say that.
So you're writing 100,000 lines, you're writing yourself.
I'm writing most of the 100,000 lines myself. Now I'm often looking up online to see like, how do you do this thing and to be inspired by how to get something done. But most of the time I'm writing the 100,000 lines myself. I'm going to take it farther. It's worse than that. I'm so old school. I told you I was like at the baby of the internet.
You got a bow tie on. I can't pull off the bow tie. I've tried.
I am so old school that when I have code that's producing HTML, I'm handcrafting the HTML the old school way, not with anything legitimately cool, which by the way is why it looks like a 2-year-old did it. But so lots of times I write the bad version, and then I give it to the professionals to write the good version.
Okay. All right, last question before we open it up. And this is one that you and I just talked about yesterday, but you were educating me on the long tail theory. And this has a corollary with one of our products. The corollary is, you know, our care gauge tool, and this is a tool that looks in real time at a patient's utilization, compares it with what we would estimate for that patient. And then we see, you know, can we give information to the clinicians to help them reduce unwarranted imaging, labs, meds, length of stay? Now we look at all this data, and I've always had the assumption that the most impact for that tool is in the 85-90% of patients that fit in the curve. But you kind of changed my mind a little bit on your long tail theory. So explain it to the group. And
yeah. And my goal wasn't to change your mind, although I'm glad if that worked out in a good way. That would be great. So I believe it was in Wired magazine that a seminal article came out some time back. It's hard now to know. Was that 2010 or 2000? I don't know, whatever it was. Anyway, it was an article, and I think it was in Wired, that had this theory of the long tail. And the idea was this. When you look at products, I'm going to use books because Amazon was a classic example of the long tail theory. Let's say back in my day when I was growing up, we didn't have Amazon. In fact, we didn't even have Borders or Barnes & Noble that I recall. You know, we had the local bookstore that was like in a strip mall, which was awesome, and I loved going there. But the local bookstore, there's, let's say, 15 million books, or I don't know how many. There's millions and millions of books that are in the universe. And you couldn't have millions of books in this little bookstore. And so that bookstore wanted to stay in business. And so what did they do? They did what any good bookstore would do. They bought the books that were the best sellers. So if you would look at the number one best-selling book and you would plot that, how many it sold, hundreds of thousands or something like that, right? And then you look at the number two best-selling book, less. And then the number three, and then the number four, and then the number five. And if you were to plot that out for all 15 million books, the curve would look like this. Here's the bottom. Here's zero. And then it's, you can't even tell that they're selling any as you start getting out into the rest of the tail. And if you looked at the area under the curve, which is the total number of books that are represented, in what they call the head of that curve, that where all the best sellers are, that's maybe 50% of the market. And then if you look at the long tail of the other 15 million books, that's the other 50% of the books. But no few could afford to service that big long tail because it was just so expensive. How are you going to keep 15 million books on hand? And the answer was you couldn't. And so there was a lot of unmet need in the marketplace. Well, Amazon came around and they figured out how to service that, you know, that long tail. You could get virtually anything from Amazon. And all of a sudden, two things happened. One, why would you go somewhere else? Everything you would ever want would be here. At least that's what many people thought. And then number two, now Amazon not only got the revenue and profit from the head, but they also captured the revenue on another 50% of the market. And some of the publications I'd seen claimed that more than 50% of Amazon's sales were coming from the long tail. Then they extended that into all of retail, and they were super disruptive. And then back in my day, we had this thing called the local video store that got replaced by the superstore of Blockbuster, which itself then has been replaced by Amazon Prime and Netflix and Apple, you know, TV. And so it's the same thing. Suddenly you could service this big long tail. And when the theory of the long tail, I believe, is basically if you can address the long tail, you can be a much more successful business in the marketplace. I think healthcare has had a lot of focus lately on the head of healthcare. When you look at where we spend a lot of our time and attention, it's for hypertension and diabetes and high cholesterol. These are good things. I'm not saying that's not appropriate. Something like almost 50% of all people over the age of 40 or something like that have hypertension, and maybe 20% have diabetes. It's good that we're focusing on that. It's a big, important part of our healthcare needs. But if you're sitting out in that long tail, I think there is a lot less, my personal view and experience has been that there has been a lot less attention out there. And those patients have unmet needs. And if we can find a way to have, for example, technology to help us in the long tail of healthcare, just as it helped us in retail, in books, in music, in video, in all the ways that we've seen businesses change, I think it can be transformative for healthcare. So
yeah,
that's a place where I like to focus a lot of my thought and time.
And then you were shocked when I immediately went to, holy cow, CareGage. Well, is it easier to take a day length of stay off of 15 patients on the head? Or is it easier to take 15 days off of a patient that had 150 day stay in the hospital? It might be easier to take 15 days off of that long tail patient.
Exactly. And on top of that, you may be thinking about things in ways that others aren't, making your solution even more unique.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's open it up. Let's see if folks have any questions themselves. Yeah, so question from the audience is, you know, with all these new AI models coming out, and at what point do we maybe, do clinicians lose their ability to diagnose for themselves or think for themselves if they become dependent upon these AI models? And where's the right balance there of, you know, those two things?
Yeah, that's getting a lot of attention and thought because especially now that this generative AI looks so promising. We'll see. By the way, anytime anyone makes a prediction about the future, and especially me, you should take it with the grain of salt that it deserves, because it's almost certain to be wrong. And so everything I've said is probably going to be wrong, and will say is probably going to be wrong. But with that said, part of me is looking forward to the day that that's a problem. That our AI is so good that we have the potential to be diagnostically lazy, and that it's so pervasive, because I think we're, as much as we've done, at the end of the day, the vast majority of all the work that we do, I think, in healthcare today is still exactly as you say. It's a doctor or a nurse or a clinician or another provider, you know, thinking hard and doing the best that they can. And at the end of the day, we do have a problem. And the problem is that we're not at the level of perfection, for example, that the airline industry has, and we want to get there. And the growth in medical knowledge is so fast that no human could ever keep up. We have to have some help. And I think we're lagging in the help that we have from artificial intelligence. So part of me is like, let's just catch up to where we need to be. And then we can start worrying about
discussion.
Have the discussion about, you know, did we go too far? Is let's say that we got there. This is where I think research is really, really important. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter who or what does the work, as long as the outcome is the best outcome for the patient. If the best outcome for the patient is the doctor or the nurse or the other, you know, clinician making that decision, then that's where that decision should lie. If the best outcome is with some AI doing it, then that's where that decision should lie. At the end of the day, it's the patients first. It's the quality of care and the outcomes first. And whatever makes that happen, I propose that may be paramount. Now, I say that, and someone may come up with some reason why I should actually rethink that. And when they do, I will rethink that. But right now, that's the position that I hold.
Yeah, another question from the audience. What were the differences between developing a homegrown EHR at a health system as opposed to then scaling that software within a large software company?
I'm going to answer that question more generally and just say what I've generally experienced as opposed to specifically what I had at Microsoft. One of the things that we did, I will say, for Microsoft, you know, we developed it organically, grew it organically in a health system, and then Microsoft acquired it. So it's different than if we had started from scratch. And when you look at a lot of the seminal things that we have in healthcare today and healthcare technology, a lot of it came from that path. If I'm not mistaken, I think the original CPOE came from organic growth in an institution that then got bought or acquired and then further scaled by a healthcare company. I think if you were to trace back the original origins of a lot of what we do, a lot of it would come through that path. But there is, of course, plenty of things out there that were born in a company in and of itself. And there are differences there. In my experience, for whatever that's worth, an important element of getting these things right is very often to have partnerships with healthcare providers and healthcare institutions, so that even if you don't develop it organically starting at the institution, you have a partner where you can make sure it's doing what you want it to do. Those kinds of things I have found to be incredibly helpful. Without them, you heard me about clonopin, right? It all sounds good in theory. When the rubber meets the road is when you know if what you have is often really good or not. And so as I developed clonopin, for example, organically at my institution, it's pretty much the same now as if I was doing it at a separate system. I'm developing it, but it's not live yet. So I don't actually know if it's any good. The good news is I have a path to make it live and then to see if it will be good. And I think that piece is often an important part of development, is having the right partners. I think that can be very helpful. I'm not saying it's required 100% of the time, but I can say that I personally would seek that in every possible case that I could. And the tighter you can have that relationship, the better. Which what we found very helpful is, what is the time it takes from when I make something new to when I actually can test it and see if it's good? Because it's almost never perfect. I'm not good enough to make something perfect on the first try. And the way I know it's not perfect is we have somebody try it and then it's terrible and they give us feedback, and then we make it a little better and then it's still terrible and they give us feedback. And that the shorter that cycle time is, the faster you get to something good, or the faster you can decide it'll never be good and then you kill it. It's not so much about the difference as it is about making sure that you have a path to vet the work that you're actually doing and to get the input on the needs.
Yeah, just another question from the audience here. You'd mentioned earlier the difference between a lot of times the users of the software being different than the buyers. But we even run into the challenge of, you know, sometimes working with innovation teams at health systems, they are just a little bit disconnected from the operational and clinical folks at the health system. And so how have you guys worked to kind of bridge that gap and make sure that cool, innovative ideas you're seeing are also getting the support of the clinical and operational stakeholders at the health system?
So I think I'll answer your question in a few ways, and you'll let me know maybe if I then answered it satisfactorily or not. First, I think it's important for an innovation team to have close ties with the operational and clinical teams, and to really understand their needs, so that when they find solutions and opportunities, they know how to talk about them appropriately, position them appropriately, identify what's going to be likely useful or less likely to be a match in terms of the needs of the different clinical and operational teams. So I think that is one important piece, is but that's up to the institution, right? That's not in your control. A second piece, of course, is that you can give them guidance on how to do that. But, you know, you're at the end of the day, you can only control your half of the equation. So that one thing is to have innovation. If you find, you know, customers that have innovation teams that have those close tie-ins with their and understand the needs of their institution, places that have a strong strategy and that are executing on that strategy, and you have a match that strategy, I think that's obviously helpful. And part of that part that you control is, you know, who you find, you know, and identify as likely customers. The other piece, though, I once wrote a blog post, and it was something to the effect of one extra click is one extra click too much. If that wasn't already clear by the you had to click on the thing to see the decision support, I'm gonna quadruple down on that. I'll tell you a little story. You remember SARS-CoV-2 is COVID. Well, that's two. I was practicing during SARS-CoV-1, which was the SARS epidemic that was terrifying at the time, but turned out not to be what, thank goodness, what COVID was. But we were worried about it when it came out. And we were sitting in at Northwestern in the heart of Chicago. And if there were people coming from the high-risk areas, they were very likely to end up, if they were sick, at our institution. So we were worried about it. And we put in some screening tools and things to help, because I had created the tracking system. We put in some screening tools for that the nurses had specifically requested. It's not like we forced it on anybody. They asked for it. But at the end of the day, the screening tools required an extra click. And so they were almost never used, very rarely used. And it really, that and every other experience I've ever had has told me that at the end of the day, all the clinicians I know, and of course I am talking from an emergency medicine standpoint, is my most personal experience, but just in general, time is their most precious resource. And many, many doctors and nurses, you're a nurse and they want you to click to document this thing or that thing. And often your choice is, I have a patient who is waiting for their aspirin after their heart attack. And I have to decide, do I give the aspirin or do I click on this? But which is the best thing I should be doing right now? And so at the end of the day, the number one thing that I have personally felt or found is drives adoption and success is, do you cost time or do you save time? And if you're trying to say, well, we cost time, but it's only a little bit, you're on the wrong side of that equation. If you save time, you're on the right side of that equation. It's a downhill, you know, good downhill, you know, like you're not walking uphill, you're riding the wave. So when PACS came in, digital radiology, back in my day, well, the way we had, I love saying back in my day. I'm glad I'm old enough to say I'm back in my day. No. Back in my day, when we had x-rays, it was, I can still big smell. Envelope. I can still, right, the big you envelope. When you open it up, you can, and you smell the chemical and then these big plastic sheets and you had to rotate it the right way and put it up on a light screen. And oh my gosh, if you had a CAT scan or an MRI and suddenly there's 20 of these things, you had to arrange the right way and look at them. Then the x-ray was underpenetrated or overpenetrated. It was a nightmare. And that's if you could find it, right? Very often, if you want to look at the old one, and I'm not kidding, we had to walk upstairs, wait in line. Then some person would go look in the stack, like an old library, and try and pull the right one. I'm sorry, we can't find this one. Or, okay, here it is. And then you go down, 30 minutes later, you have your old x-ray to compare. All of a sudden, PACS comes in. They were very worried about adoption of PACS. Oh, we need to train. We need to find a champion. We need to convince people this is going to be a good thing. I was like, no, you don't. Just put it in. I will be the champion. I'll come in and you can just turn it on. We don't need any training. We'll figure it out. We need this and we need it now. And that's exactly how it worked. We had zero problem with adoption of PACS in emergency medicine.
Still going and looking for the manual, for the...
Right. Suddenly everything, it was underpenetrated. You weren't doing another x-ray. You're just scrolling. You never had to look for an old x-ray. It was just right there. You never had to look, where's the current x-ray? It was just right there. So these were experiences that taught me that if you can save time, then your biggest problem is how do I slow adoption? I'll give you one more example. The iPhone. Everyone says that clinicians, and especially doctors, we're so technology averse. Really? Well, when the iPhone came out, I don't remember doctors being technology averse. I remember we had Hippocrates and we could suddenly look up drugs on our phone and we had all these decision support things that in clinical calculators and all this PubMed, all this reference right at our fingertips all the time. I didn't have to go out to a computer. It was just right here on my phone. And I'm not, maybe I shouldn't have said a specific name, but we just had lots and lots of resources available to us. And suddenly everybody was bringing their iPhone and IT had no way to control it. And it was terrifying. And suddenly they were trying to put policy in and slow it down. And so all these things came together and had led me to believe that, the way to make adoption happen is to save the user's time. And that way you create a value proposition for the buyer and you have a built-in value proposition for the user. And that is something you can control because that's your product. And at the end of the day, that's my answer to you. If it's not a good answer, it's the only one I have.
Yeah. Well, John, thank you for joining us today, not only for the Better Care podcast, but for joining us in person at our full company meeting. And we appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Better Care podcast. Please see the episode show notes for additional information and clarifications. To ensure you never miss an episode, we encourage you to subscribe to the podcast on your preferred platform. Additionally, your ratings and reviews are invaluable in helping us reach a wider audience. Please consider leaving a review, and if you do, email us a screenshot at marketing@evidence.care, and we'll send you a thank you gift. For access to exclusive content and further healthcare insights created by Evidence Care, please visit evidence.care/bettercarepodcast and subscribe to our email list. We appreciate your support and look forward to connecting soon.